The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm Neil Kerwin, and I want to welcome all of you here this afternoon and thank you for joining us at this most important event. On behalf of the faculty, students, staff, and alumni, President Carter, I welcome you back to American University. President Carter, as you know, American University is a community of learning. It is comprised of people from virtually every nation in the world. We take pride in our tradition of reaching out to people of all backgrounds and the rich diversity that that creates here. American University has a deep commitment to other fundamental values, a respect for humanity, deep and unrestrained inquiry, freedom of expression, decency and civility, and service to our community, to our nation, and to our world. We're a place where great leaders and thinkers come to share their ideas and insights with members of a community dedicated to changing our world for the better. Today, we welcome you as a man whose life and career exemplifies many of the things we aspire to as an institution. We are truly honored by your presence. To mark this event, I want to present you with a token of our esteem. It carries the symbol of American University, and I hope it will serve as a reminder of this day and this institution's very high regard for you and your work. Mr. President, I also would like now to bring our student government president, Mr. Kyle Taylor, to the stage. Kyle is a senior from Anaheim, California, who is a major in the School of International Service. Under his leadership and the leadership of many, many student volunteers, including Jasmine Gorawara and Ali Bouch, both of whom are from New Orleans and AU students, and I think with us here today, American University students have held a variety of events to assist victims of Hurricane Katrina. The funds they've raised will be donated to Habitat for Humanity. Plans are also underway for an alternative spring break to assist with the recovery effort. Kyle will now present you with a gift on behalf of American University students. It is now my pleasure to introduce my colleague, Dr. Robert Pastor, the Vice President of International Affairs and a professor in the School of International Service. We all know Bob as a respected scholar who has worked hard to continue this university's long tradition and commitment to becoming a truly premier global university. Dr. Pastor holds his PhD from Harvard University, and prior to coming to American University, was a professor at Emory University. He is the author of more than a dozen books, hundreds of articles, and he now, among other things, directs our Center for North American Studies and the Center for Democracy and Election Management, which housed the Carter-Baker Commission on Election Reform. Dr. Pastor has long been associated with President Carter, serving as a senior official in his National Security Council. Bob has served also as a foreign policy advisor to every Democratic presidential candidate since 1976. At the Carter Center, Bob organized the monitoring of elections in more than 20 countries. It's my pleasure to present to you Dr. Robert Pastor.
Thank you very much. I have the very distinct honor of introducing to the American University community the greatest person I have ever known. I use the word greatest with care, and not because he won the Nobel Peace Prize. If the criterion for judging greatness is the magnitude of one's contribution to resolving conflicts, promoting human rights and democracy, and eradicating diseases, I can think of no one in the past 30 years who has done more than Jimmy Carter. My great good fortune is that I've worked with him during that time for 30 years and witnessed firsthand his triumphs and his good works. Born in a small town, Plains, Georgia, Jimmy Carter rose to the presidency with genuine courage, acute intelligence, an iron determination, and a winning charm. When others said he stood no chance of becoming president or that he could not solve a particular problem, he has always smiled and just did it over and over again. His strength and idealism combined to lead him to negotiate Panama Canal treaties, an act of statesmanship from which each of his predecessors flinched. He defined for our time the centrality of human rights for U.S. foreign policy and the world. At 80 years old, he still builds houses for the poor, and 2 days ago, he returned from a grueling trip to Central Africa where he is eradicating two dreaded diseases. Many have called him the greatest ex-president America has ever had, and that is true. But I also believe that he's one of the greatest presidents of the 20th century. Besides the canal treaties, consider what else he accomplished. The Camp David peace accords, normalization of relations with China, the SALT II treaties, creation of the departments of education, of energy, human rights, the largest expansion of the national park system in American history, the Tokyo round of trade negotiations. I could go on and on. But the purpose today is to hear him speak about the commission that he has co-chaired with James Baker to restore confidence in our own democracy. That commission on federal election reform presented its report to the president today. It's been organized by American University. And he would like to talk with you about that for about 10 minutes, then take your questions on the subject of our democracy, and then open it for your questions on whatever subject that you would like to raise with him. Students, faculty, staff, friends of AU, I ask all of you to stand and welcome a model of decency and integrity that makes America proud, the inspiration of my generation and yours, and the greatest person you are going to meet, Jimmy Carter.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Well, as Bob Pastor said, he and I have been together for 30 years. And that's the best introduction he has ever given me, and I really appreciate it. It must be the beneficent influence of American University on him. He's mellowed a lot since I first knew him. As a matter of fact, 25 years ago, Bob and I were neighbors of American University until I was involuntarily retired from the White House as a result of the 1980 election. Bob has been very close to me in many ways. He was my national security advisor in the White House when America adopted as a basic foundation for our foreign policy the protection of human rights around the world. And later, when he worked with me at the Carter Center, Bob was the originator of the Carter Center's commitment to establish democracy and freedom in many other countries, beginning in Latin America. As Bob said, I just returned Saturday afternoon from Mali, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. The Ethiopian election held on May the 15th, and just now coming to a close, was the 61st election that the Carter Center and I have monitored. And next month we'll be going for the 62nd election in Liberia. This commitment to freedom, democracy, openness, fairness has been a great deal inherited by me from the advice from Bob Pastor. This last few months, we have addressed one of the most difficult and sometimes embarrassing aspects of the United States of America. As we have observed other elections around the world, we've seen standards established and improved that now make us in some ways ashamed of our own system, or at least apologetic for the system. Other countries have electronic voting. They also have a paper proof of the way you voted. Invariably, other countries have a central election commission that guarantees uniformity of the voting ballot and the procedure of voting in every place in the whole country. We have about 4,400 different voter centers in almost every county in this country. Other nations provide that all the candidates who qualify have equal access to television and radio to present their views to the people of our country. In our country, you can't do that unless you are rich. So, Dr. Pastor and I have recognized a long time that we had some problems in the American system. But I don't think the American people ever became aware of them until after the year 2000, when for weeks after weeks we didn't know who won the election in Florida and therefore who was to be elected our President of the United States. As a result of that difficulty, former President Gerald Ford, a Republican friend of mine, and I headed up an election study commission. And we had a wide range of highly partisan but dedicated people who worked with us. We made recommendations to the President and to the Congress, and the Help America Vote Act, HAVA or HAVA, was passed. This is really the first time that the Congress has ever taken such a major step into trying to provide uniformity in our country about the electoral procedures, because under our system of federalism, historically this has been a preserve, politically speaking, of the states individually. But we wanted to make them more uniform. So the HAVA was passed, and it took a great step forward. However, this new law was not adequate. And in 2004, we still have some problems. And we've tried to address those in this recent effort by a bipartisan commission headed by me and former Secretary of State James Baker, an ardent Republican. And we had 19 other members and American University staff under Dr. Pastor's direction did the hard work and provided the leadership. And today the report is finally complete. And this morning we met with the President, and Karl Rove was there to demonstrate the interest of the White House in politics, if you doubted that at all. And then we went from the White House over to the Capitol, where we were able to present this to some key members of Congress and also to the staffs of the major committees that will decide what new legislation will be forthcoming. I won't go into detail about what we did. But one of the things that we did, I'll just give you a few things. One is we would like to see that every state official who is in charge of the election in that particular state is nonpartisan, at least as far as the national election is concerned. As you may remember, in Florida in 2000, the chairman of the Republican election campaign for president was also the Secretary of State, ostensibly a balanced administrator of the election process. And the same thing happened last election in Ohio. So that's one of our recommendations, that there be a nonpartisan and obviously unbiased person or persons in charge of the electoral process in each state. Another recommendation we made 4 years ago was that the states have uniform voter registration and then also a uniform system of voting. And many states have moved toward electronic voting. But there's not much confidence in the secrecy within a computer system that the software is fair and unbalanced and not corrupt. And also people want to know, when I punch this screen and I get ready to walk out of the polling place, how have I voted? So we are advocating that there be a paper trail to show a voter. After we vote, look at the paper record and say, yes, that is the way I voted. And then if there is a close election, then you can compare the paper ballots with the electronic tabulation to make sure that they were accurate. And also in advance, we want every election official to know that there's going to be an audit of every election. We've never had that before. But in the future, there will be an audit. So that, let's say, for instance, 1% of all the voting places in a state chosen at random and not anticipated in advance will be double-checked to see if they are exactly the same, the paper ballots and the electronic ballots. We want to make sure that there is not discrimination against people and that as many folks as possible are registered to vote and that those that come forward to vote are the people who are on the voters list. Well, I come from Georgia, and I've been embarrassed that my own state passed a law this year that, in effect, takes away the basic right of people to register and vote, particularly if they are poor or African-American or aged. I hate to admit this, but the legislature, I don't think you need to guess which party it is. I won't say that in order to be nonpartisan. It was not my party. I don't want to say which one it was. Passed a law, you won't believe this, that every person in the future has to have an official photo identification card issued by the state. We have 159 counties. These will be issued only in 56 places around Georgia. None of the places where you can go and get a photo ID card are in Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta votes heavily for my party. I won't say which one it is. And also, and this is almost unbelievable, you have to pay for the photo ID card. $20 for a 5-year voting right. $35 if you want to have the right to vote for 10 years. As you know, we have a Voting Rights Act in our country. And this was appealed to the Justice Department, and they approved this process. I won't remind you which party is in charge of the Justice Department. But now there's a lawsuit that might set this aside. These are the kinds of problems that we are trying to resolve in this commission. You can see that they're very serious problems. And they have convinced about more than one-third of the total people in this great democracy under public opinion polls that I'm not confident that my vote will be accurately tabulated. That's what we're trying to resolve. And I want to express my public gratitude to Dr. Pastor, to all of his staff here at American University for taking the leadership on it, because it's Bob's initiative that actually resulted in the establishment of this commission, and they have provided the assistance for us. So if our country in the future has a good, decent, honest, respectable, dependable, and fair election process, American University, I would say, can take most of the credit. Thank you for that.
President Carter is going to take questions. We recommend that you line up. There are two mics over there. We'll start right there.
Yeah, hi, President Carter. My name is Derek Henkel. I'm with
ABC. I'm sorry for one second. There are a couple of speakers right in front of you, okay?
Okay.
That's okay.
President Carter, in your extensive report, you propose changing the American primary system from being state-based to being four regional primaries to avoid the front-loading that has typified the primary contest. How do you propose to convince political parties, which are non-governmental agencies and very loosely regulated to begin with, to change their primary schedule willingly?
Okay. This was a problem that America has faced for a long time, and the staff assessed the fact that in the primary seasons in previous elections, when the Democratic and Republican nominees have been selected to represent our parties for president, at the end of that process, only 8% of the American voters have been able to cast their ballots to participate. And by that time, the other 92% have to face the fact that the decision's already been made. So the secretaries of state of all the 50 states have long recommended that we leave, I would say, Iowa and New Hampshire alone, let them go first, and then after that, you'd have regional voting with the East Coast, the Midwest, the West, and then the coast, West Coast. And so that's what we are recommending. And the first presidential election, the East Coast might vote first, or it might be chosen by ballot. But after that, there would be a rotating system, so different ones would go first each 4 years. Well, We're going to present this, obviously, to the major political parties, Democrat and Republican Party, also to the state governments, the Governor's Conference and others, and also to the Congress. As a matter of fact, the Congress itself, under the U.S. Constitution, has the authority to prescribe this system. And we don't have any assurance that it'll be done. But we believe that our recommendation will be considered by the American people, and they'll say we really need this change and induce the Congress members to make the change, or either the political parties themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Adam, identify your name first and your class, if you could.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. President. My name is Adam Cohen. I'm the president of the Student Bar Association at the Washington College of Law, American University's Law School. And my question is regarding the voter ID provision specifically.
Yes.
You touched on that briefly, but under HAVA passed a number of provisions and mandates on the states that HAVA has not been fully funded to date. A number of states have not completed their application requirements, and I know the time is coming up, I believe, in 2006 for the final requirements to be there. The voter ID provision, it will be mandatory, but if Congress fails to fund this implementation of the voter ID provision, how do we ensure this does not become a de facto poll tax in the end that falls on a poor and elderly?
Good. I have to say, dealing with the photo ID requirement, that this was a difficult thing for me at the beginning of this process. If you had asked me 5 months ago, I would have said no. But when I saw what Georgia had done, and when I realized that 24 states have now required voter identification before voting, and 12 other states are considering this change, first of all, I felt that a uniform system would be better than having each state go individually with bias or discrimination being a real prospect. Secondly, we put in some very careful safeguards to make sure that this Georgia debacle is not repeated. For instance, we require that every photo ID card be free of charge. Third, that there be an aggressive voter registration process in every state to go out and reach people who have never been registered before as they acquire a photo ID card. You might remember the so-called Motor Voter Act that was passed a number of years ago, and this May, 2005, the Congress passed a law called Real ID. In the future, anyone who gets on an airplane, anyone who gets a driver's license, anyone who cashes a check, anyone who goes in many federal buildings will have to have one of these Real ID cards. So that's going to be an all-pervasive requirement anyhow. So we thought if we tagged on to that process, which is already passed into law, that it would be a good way to do it. We know it's going to take a little time to implement this. So until the year 2010, under our recommendation, if you go to the polls and you don't have a photo ID card, you can cast a provisional ballot, and that will count just as well. And after 2010, if say you have the photo ID card and you've lost it, you'll be granted 48 hours to get your credentials and come back and prove that you meet your requirements. So we've built in all kind of safeguards to make sure that it's uniformity, that it's free of charge, it's not discriminatory, and in fact, we believe it will greatly increase the number of people, particularly the poor and the African-American and old people, that are not registered now. One of our key people who came and gave testimony at a commission meeting in Atlanta in last of August was Andrew Young. Andrew Young believes that this is one of the greatest moves to be made to encourage increased participation by those who at this moment are excluded.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, right there.
Hello, President Carter. My name is Derek Hankel. I'm also a student here, and I'm a journalist with ABC and CNN. And I wanted to ask you a couple things. We're real familiar with grading here at the university. Okay. So I wanted to ask you.
I'll take my choice. You ask me too, I'll take my choice.
Okay, they both deal with grading, so they'll have a common theme. First of all, I'd love to ask you to grade the last two, not the administrations, but the elections that brought those administrations to power. If you were to give letter grades to what has now been the last four elections presidentially in this country, I would love that. And also on the grade scale, I know you, by executive order in 1979, I believe, signed FEMA into power. And I really am curious as to what your views are of how the situation is being managed right now on the ground. And if you would go into some grading of what you think has gone right and what's gone wrong in this effort, and if you'd look forward and talk about where you think we need to go, especially in the light that residents are returning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I would say that in the year 2000, the country failed abysmally in the presidential election process. There's no doubt in my mind that Al Gore was elected president. He received the most votes nationwide, and in my opinion, he also received the most votes in Florida. And the decision was made, as you know, by a 5-4 vote on a highly partisan basis by the U.S. Supreme Court. So I would say in 2000, there was a failure. The year 2004 is hard to grade. You know, I don't have any detailed information about what actually went on in Ohio. If Ohio had gone one way or the other, it would have changed the outcome of the election. And the only thing that I know about Ohio was that there's general consensus that the Secretary of State of Ohio, who was responsible for the administration of the election, was highly partisan in his public approach and perhaps even in his private administration, but I don't know about that. As far as FEMA is concerned, I founded FEMA in 1979 as a direct response from a petition given to me by the National Governors Conference. Because at that time there were 16 different federal agencies that dealt with disasters like Katrina or other things. And we put it together and with three specific commitments that I hoped at that time were permanent. One was that it would be headed by highly qualified professionals in dealing with disasters. Secondly, that it would be completely independent and not under another agency that would submerge it secondarily. And third, that it would be adequately funded. Well, I thought that would be a permanent commitment. But as you know, all three of those provisions have been violated in recent years. And obviously, there were defaults at the local and state level, other things at the federal level. So I think now is the best time not to look back on blaming about Katrina, but to try to correct the defects that have evolved in recent years and make sure it's not repeated. Before I answer a question, I would like to make a comment. I've been in politics since 1962. I ran for the state senate of Georgia, and I served there. And I have observed a lot of people in politics. One of the greatest men I know and one of my heroes in the realm of human rights and equity is Julian Bond, and I would like to recognize his presence. Thank you. By the way, in 1974, when I announced for president, there was a Gallup poll run, and among American Democrats, who do you think ought to be the next president? There were 36 people on the list. I was not on the list. Julian Bond was on the list above me. Julian, I'm glad to see you again. Good luck to you.
Mr. Professor, sir.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. President. My name is Joe Galina. I'm a senior here in SPA. This is Kosima Wadwa. She's a junior in SOC here at AU. As you know, only 46% of 18 to 24-year-olds vote.
Yeah.
Kosim and I have started a club this semester to try to get as many AU students as registered to vote as possible and to encourage them to be active participants in the electoral process. What is your advice to students like us to promote just election behavior and to make our make it as easy as possible for our peers to vote?
Well, first of all, I think that in this past election, there was an increase in the number of student participations. And that was a good omen, hopefully, for the future. The point is that it's a personal commitment to make. And the inspiration of young people as well as old people to vote has to come from within. Is it worth my trouble to make sure I'm registered to vote? Do I believe that my vote will make a difference? Do I believe that my vote will be counted accurately? Do I believe that I will have an influence on my candidate if my choice is successful? Do I have confidence in the basic integrity of my own country? Do I believe that I can shape our nation in the future to commit to the principles that I personally believe? Peace, equity, human rights, freedom, democracy, protection of the environment, the alleviation of suffering. Do I believe I can make a difference? And so all of those questions have to be assessed by an individual person to decide, am I going to go to the trouble of registering to vote and vote? And I think that student organizations within a campus can set a goal for yourself of 95% of all the students registered to vote. And keep up the campaign for registration the entire year. It doesn't take but a couple of people like you to keep this on the forefront. You can put up placards and so forth and use it through the newspaper, but it has to be driven. And I think somebody like you can drive it. This is not an easy thing to do. When I was governor, I was faced with the prospect that not many of our young people voted. So I got the legislature to pass a law, Julian Bond voted for it, that authorized every high school principal to be a voter registrar. So every May the 15th, I would set aside one day that week for voter registration. And the high school principal would be the one in charge of registering all the students that had gotten to be 18 years old that year. And they had to report to me what their percentage of registration was. So I think that if you just keep this up, if American University does it, suppose you get 95% of all the American University students registered to vote. Man, that would make a wave of impact in campuses that are not nearly so advanced as yours, like Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and things like that.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you. My name is Zoe Toby. I'm a student at the Washington Semester Program and grassroots organizer at FairVote, the Center for Voting and Democracy. Mr. President, thank you for a lifetime of service to American and global society, first of all.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. And Dr. Pastor, thank you for your leadership on this commission as well. So I read the long-awaited report this morning, and while full of reasonable reform proposals, it does not seem as ambitious as the times warrant. It does not seem to address how we can ensure basic principles of one person, one vote, majority rule, and full representation. I'm wondering, what were the commission's conversations, and where do you and Dr. Pastor personally stand on the following three reforms: direct election of the president, instant runoff voting for federal elections, and election of the House of Representatives through multi-member districts and proportional voting to ensure representation for all instead of winner-take-all?
Well, those are all theoretically advisable. You know, if I was writing the American Constitution 220 years ago, it may have been better to have a direct election of the president. But the Constitution prescribes that we have the Electoral College. And my, not guess, but my assurance is that this will never happen during your lifetime or mine. Because we couldn't get three-fourths of the states and two-thirds of the House and Senate members to vote for a constitutional amendment to change it. However, there is an escape valve here with which I'm sure you're familiar, and that is that each state can decide to allot its presidential electoral votes on the same percentage as the popular vote was cast. A couple of states do this already. Any state could do it if it wanted to, and that's something that your organization could pursue because most people don't know that. As far as the other provisions, the other recommendations that you recommended, well, we had an evenly divided group of members, half Republican, half Democrat, very deeply partisan in nature. So we had to reach the highest possible common denominator that we could reach. And I have to tell you, I'm just proud we didn't reach the lowest common denominator. And one of the saving, there were two saving things about it. One was the superb work that the staff did in putting it together. The other one was the somewhat rare personal compatibility between me and former Secretary of State James Baker. We didn't argue with each other. We honestly tried to find the best proposals that we felt we could get a majority of people to support. So some of the ideas that may have been theoretically advisable, I wouldn't question them, but we had to be more practical, and you have a personal right to be somewhat disappointed that we did have to cut corners on occasion in order to reach a consensus. I'm not apologizing, I'm just explaining.
Thank you.
I think, as for me, since you have me all of the time, as a professor American, I'll answer that question another time, but let me take the opportunity of asking my staff if they would stand and identify themselves. They have been recognized by President Carter, and I'd like to recognize them as well. Daniel Kallengart, please stand. Kay Stimson, Nicole, Paulina, Vasia, Murray, anybody else I can't see right now, please stand, and let us thank you for all the work that you've done. And let me say that all of the students out there who are engaged in different issues related to elections and democracy, we welcome your involvement and engagement, both in looking towards this report and looking beyond the report as well. Over there.
Thank you, Mr. Carter, for joining us today. You're certainly more charming than your colleague, John Edwards, who also spoke here. You'll have to bear with me as my heart is in my throat right now. Okay. My name is Jacques Ledbetter. I'm a senior in SPA. And as someone who has a best friend in Iraq right now, and seeing how these are uncertain times for democracy and the United States leadership in the world, And as the president who's supposed to be an educated, honest, and honorable person, who's supposed to uphold the virtues of fair representation, responsibility, and accountability in government, how can future presidents, or maybe including this one as well, use their unique powers to restore confidence in our democracy?
Could you understand the question?
Yeah. See, my heart was in
well, obviously, one of the ways that any president can improve confidence in the democracy is to be courageous and frank in acknowledging the defects in our system. It's very hard for an American citizen or certainly a public official to say we have problems in this greatest democracy on earth. And to say we do have defects and let's resolve them would be a major step forward. So I would say that the incumbent president, President George W. Bush, I would hope that he might endorse the recommendations that we have made and that the Congress would act accordingly, that the Democratic and Republican members would do so. But I think there has to be a realization that the number one voice that can influence the American people in controversial issues, certainly in one's own party, is the President of the United States. And we don't yet know what position President Bush will take on this proposal. We presented it to him this morning, as I mentioned earlier. I would hope that he would endorse it, or at least say this was a good report. There are a few things about it with which I don't agree, but we hope that Congress will favorably consider it, and also all the states will do so. So for the President to repeat myself, acknowledge our own faults, make sure that the American people know these are the changes that need to be made. If so, we'll have full confidence in the integrity of our election. Those are the things that the President can do. Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, Mr. President. My name is Connor Bukowski, and I'm a dying breed of your party from the South as well. I just wanted to say, because you've said so much about our fine institution today, and in light of certain recent problems, I'd like to give you a very, very, very unofficial invitation to submit your resume as president of our school.
I second the nomination.
Well, I have two responses. One is my wife would not permit me to leave Plains and her for the rest of our lives. We've been together 59 years. We'd like to spend two more years together.
Congratulations.
And secondly, every Sunday I teach classes in my Bible school in Maranatha Baptist Church. And I couldn't do this both at the same time. So those are the two main reasons that I don't accept your invitation. But thank you very much for the compliment.
Thank you for your time.
Hello, President Carter. My name is Pia Jordan. I was a student in the master's program in the School of Communications. First of all, I did vote for you when you were running for president. And I just want to give you my testimony. I'm here. I'm from Baltimore. And I admire you, and I have admired you for years as a man of principle, as a man of faith. And I have two questions for you. Based on what we're seeing dealing with terrorism now, would you have done anything differently during your administration dealing with Afghanistan? And my second question is, do you think during your time, the Iran hostage situation may have been manipulated so that the hostages were brought home after the election that you lost?
Well, do we have time for this question? Well, first of all, Afghanistan was a nation that was invaded by the Soviet Union when I was there. So, secretly, I tried to ensure that the Soviet Union would not be successful in completely occupying permanently the nation of Afghanistan. So we gave all the help we could secretly for the freedom fighters who were against Soviet occupation. And I made a public announcement that if the Soviet Union moved out of Afghanistan with success, which they didn't realize, and down through Iran and down through other countries to the Indian Ocean, that we would consider this a direct threat to our own country and that I would respond accordingly. And it was partially because of that that the Soviets were not successful in taking over and occupying Afghanistan. After the Soviets withdrew, I had left the office of president by then, Afghanistan cried out for substantial assistance in establishing a democratic form of government and correcting the damage that had been done to that country by Soviet occupying troops. That assistance was not forthcoming. And it was because of that, partially, the other factors, that the Taliban established ultimately their regime and that Osama bin Laden and others came in and orchestrated the terrorist attacks that have now permeated the world as a threat. So that's what happened on Afghanistan. As far as the hostages were concerned, this was the biggest problem that I faced when I was president. The hostages were taken in Iran, as you know, they were completely innocent diplomats. 52 of them were kept for almost 14 months. I was faced with a difficult question. Most of my advisors said we need to take military action against Iran. I decided instead to issue a warning to Ayatollah Khomeini, who was a religious and political leader. I told him that if a hostage was injured, that we would stop all trade between Iran and the outside world. If a hostage was killed, that we would launch a military attack against Iran. I could have destroyed Iran with our massive military capability. Fortunately, the Ayatollah listened to my warning and never was a hostage injured or killed. I had two goals in mind. One was to protect the integrity of my country, and the other one was to bring every hostage home safe and free. And I thank God that both those prayers were answered. As far as influence, not to release the hostages until I was out of office. The hostages were in an airplane on the end of the runway, inauguration morning at 9:30, ready to take off, and they didn't take off until 12:05 after I was no longer president. I'm sure that was a decision made just by the Ayatollah. I'll let you think what you want.
Please, if you have a question, let's limit it to one. We want to give several more people to ask. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, President Carter. My name is Brennan Steidel. I'm a student in the School of Communications here at American University.
Yes.
And earlier today, you talked about increasing voter participation in our democracy.
Yes.
This summer, I worked for the Department of Elections in Volusia County, Florida, and I was thinking about increasing participation because there's such low voter turnout and registration in our country. And I came up with the idea of maybe introducing a tax across the board for all Americans, maybe an income tax, very small, put that money in a pot, and then each time someone walks in to vote, they get $5 or $10 so that, you know, maybe they can go out to dinner afterwards. And I know that this would increase, you know, voting among people in poverty, but also, you know, even if you make $200,000 a year, if you go to vote, you're going to want your $5 or $10 back. So right. I just want to see what you think about that idea.
I think it's very interesting. Thank you very much for your innovative thought.
Hi, President Carter. I'm Andrew Robinson. I'm just a freshman here at NSIS, and I have a short, not very in-depth or maybe well thought out question, but has the Carter Baker Commission been involved in Iraq at all, and will it in the future?
No, the Coda Baker Commission was confined its responsibilities just to the future election process in the United States. The Carter Center, though, as I mentioned earlier, we have helped to monitor 61 different nations. One of the things that we don't do at the Carter Center is to duplicate what others are doing. So if the United States is orchestrating an election through our government, or if the United Nations is in charge of an election like in Iraq, we don't participate. We just go to countries that are in need, and when the ruling party and the government ask us to come in, and the major opposition parties, and we see that the election is not going to be successful, if we don't go, then we consider going into the country. But the Carter Center is a small organization, and we can only do about 5 elections each year. And we will continue to do that, but we didn't take on Iraq. The largest election that we've ever done was in Indonesia, now 7 years ago. Indonesia had never seen a democratic election, but the Carter Center went in and worked with Indonesian people and orchestrated a very successful democratic election. And now Indonesia, the 4th largest nation in the world and the largest Islamic nation on earth, has very honest and fair democratic elections. So it's interesting, I believe, to make one other comment, that the 3 largest democracies on earth that have major election successes are the United States and India and Indonesia. The United States, majority Christian. India, Hindu. Indonesia, Muslim. So it's not a religious thing that leads to a democracy. It transcends religious faith, and it's a common desire and dream of every American to be free and to choose one's own leaders. That's why we worked on this commission.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm afraid we're only going to take 2 more questions, okay? Let's go over here.
Hello, President Carter. Hi. My name is Amitai Perlin. I am a Vassar College student, and this summer I interned for Radio Disney. In 2004, British Columbia appointed 160-member Citizens Assembly, the same way we assign people to jury duty, to study and make recommendations for electoral reforms. Through democratic deliberations and expert testimony, they decided to recommend ranked voting with multi-member districts. Now, given how the public tends to be less partisan than our politicians, would a commission of the people make sense to you?
What's the last part of the question? Would the
given how the public tends to be less partisan than politicians, would you recommend a commission of the people?
Commission of the people.
Yeah, commission of the people. They recommend proportional representation, which is actually voted down.
Yeah, well, Bob points out that they made a recommendation of proportional representation, and it was voted down. Well, I think some states, as you know, are heavily dependent on proposals that are presented directly to the people through petitions. California is a state of this kind, and so in that state and some others as well, groups of citizens can prepare a petition and then let it be submitted as a referendum, and it transcends the decision that a legislature and a governor can make. So that's always an escape valve. But I would certainly have no objection to a citizens-oriented election commission that would parallel the work that we've just done. The problem you face there is how do you put it together so it's not all designed to ferment and to implement one particular point of view? You know, how do you make it somewhat balanced? How do you make it parallel to some degree what is ultimately going to be faced in a state legislature or the Congress? So that's one advantage of this. But I think citizens originating ideas is a very good proposition. Maybe one more question. Bob's the leader here.
Hi, I'm Jason Oliver. I'm a freshman in the School of Public Affairs. I've got a question about the Iran hostage crisis.
Yes.
Was it not an American embarrassment to your administration in front of the world and for America that you allowed passively allowed American citizens to be held hostage and maybe have effects that we are now feeling today with the upstart of possible fundamental and radical groups?
Well, it was certainly an embarrassment to me and a disappointment that the American hostages were held during that time. I believe it's accurate to say that there was unanimous condemnation from all other nations on earth that the American hostages were held during that time. And I don't believe at all that the hostage crisis contributed to the increase of terrorism that we've experienced now 25 years later. But I would have done anything within reason in my own life I would have done anything in my life that I could have then to bring the hostages back safe and free earlier. But as I said earlier, I'm grateful they finally all did come back safe and free. Well, can I close? Let me... Bob says the time's run out and I have to catch a plane. I don't have Air Force One anymore. I have to depend on Delta, and Delta's just gone into bankruptcy, so I'm going to try to get to the airport. But let me say this. We've discussed this afternoon, as you know, in this brief period of time, some very important issues that relate to our nation, its integrity, its reputation, its relationship with countries around the world. Some of the issues I'm sure that were important to all the questioners and maybe to you. The bright spot about the future is not with me or Jim Baker or the commission members that have served, nor even people like Bob Pastor. The bright spot in this country is you. It's the young people who can look at your life with increasing degree of understanding and comprehension now that Google has come along. And you can instantaneously know what's being done here and what's being done around the world. And you are in a very unique period in your life. You're in an environment that encourages exchange of contradicting ideas. And you can assess those ideas and select the ones that you want, and you can promulgate them without fear of punishment or intimidation. And this is a transient time in your existence. 4 or 5 years from now, all of you are going to have heavy obligations. If you're a teacher or in business world or financial world, or if you are a lawyer or whatever, in pleasing the people around you, you are obviously going to have more of you married and have a financial responsibility to your family. And the freedom that you now have is going to be subsumed by the obligation to earn a regular paycheck to meet your obligations to the people that you love. Now is the time to have a burning desire to see your own life and the life of this nation enhanced. We live in the greatest, most powerful country on earth. America's military budget is equal to the combined budget of all the nations in the world. I don't think that's the measure of greatness. So a reasonable question of you is, what is... A reasonable question of you is, what is the definition of greatness? And I think you can look at one person and say, what is greatness? I think that there's an direct parallel between the greatness of a person and the greatness of our nation. I would like to see the United States of America be looked upon throughout the world as a preeminent nation that espouses peace, not preemptive war. I would like for our country to be looked upon as a symbol of democracy and freedom, so that the electoral system in America, the example of democracy, is without blemish. And that's what we've been working on recently. I would like to see America be looked upon as the nation on earth that holds highest the banner of basic human rights. And those rights apply to American citizens and to others. And I would like to see our country be looked upon as the most generous nation on earth, the most responsive to the needs of other people. We have a long way to go in that last respect. If you take the income of America, national income, in our total foreign aid package, we only give 16 cents per $100. It's the lowest contribution on earth toward the alleviation of suffering among poor people. That needs to be increased. So those are the kind of standards for you to set for yourselves and for you to ensure they were set collectively for what I believe ought to be the greatest nation on earth. Thank you very much.
Nobody mentioned interest rate.